Strap that holds the guardian ring. Spin let loose a wearing thin. A wearing thin. The biting through. The shifting power leans to you. And the cord is on a wheel.
Very, very faint. Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, host of Wednesday morning call-in talk radio here on KBOO Community Radio, where the time is almost 36 minutes before, or 24 minutes before 8 o'clock. And you, the number to call to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. And this room is full of candidates that are running for City Commission position number 3. A position that's currently held by Dan Saltzman. We are actually still setting up as we're talking here because we have 5 candidates in a room that really fits 3 guests. So kind of bear with us for a moment while we are still kind of getting everybody settled down. So in this room this morning, there are 4 people I'm familiar with, and one person is going to have to introduce himself. We have Dan Saltzman, who currently holds the seat. We have Chris Iverson to my left here, if you were actually watching us, Amanda Fritz, Sharon Nassett, and Mike Casper, who's the dark horse candidate because he's not in the voter's pamphlet. So I did my homework from the voter's pamphlet, and Mike is going to have to fill me in on who he is. So I'm going to have you start by each talking about, very briefly, kind of distinguishing what your positions are and, well, in Dan's case, what distinguishes you as a city councilman, why the voters should reelect you. And this should be a very quick pitch. We're not going to go into long campaign things here. But what I'm very interested in, because it seems that on a lot of these issues, you're all kind of in agreement. So I want to know, like, how you're all different. So we'll start with Dan, since he's the incumbent.
Well, good morning, Barbara. I am Dan Saltzman, and I'm seeking reelection. And I'm really seeking reelection because I want to continue to work on the issues that I'm passionate about. And those are really 3 things. One is making Portland a family-friendly city, making sure that every child has a shot at success. Secondly, is continuing to protect our environment and advancing sustainable development policies in our city. And third is making sure that we give good value for our taxpayer dollars, making sure that government is run cost-effectively and efficiently. And I've established a reputation, I think, as somebody that has an independent voice on the city council.
Okay, Mike?
I decided to run for Portland City Council because I believe that I have the ability to make change and bring people together. I'm concerned with the direction of the city and my generation, the 18 to 35, as it's quickly growing and becoming the fastest demographics in Portland. I think that we need some leadership that starts from the bottom up rather than the top down. I think I have some unique experiences, just life experiences, working 2 jobs in Portland, supporting a family, providing for 2 children, finding schools and housing, affordable housing. I think all of these things I can bring to the table a unique stance on where the city can be going in the next 10 years.
And Mike, how old are you? Just for
I'm 33 years old.
Okay, so you're a little older than the demographics that you're planning on representing.
A little bit.
Okay. Amanda?
I'm Amanda Fritz. I'm a nurse and a mom and a neighborhood activist. I served on the Planning Commission for 7 years. So I have a different perspective on how the city should be run. I'm concerned that we haven't made the city more family-friendly over the last 8 years. And I think I can provide the neighborhood voice to be a champion for children, for neighborhoods, and to just offer that different perspective on some of the issues, many of the values we share and many of the values people share all over Portland. It's a matter of having a voice on the city council that can give a little bit different perspective.
And Amanda, you mentioned before we went on that even though a lot of you have the same positions, that you have a different perspective. And could you just sum up very briefly, what is the difference between your perspective, even though you and Dan may agree on larger environmental issues or school issues, what is the perspective that you would bring that's different?
Well, I've lived here in Portland for 20 years. I have 3 children who've been through the public schools and one who's now at one of the public universities in Oregon. I've lived my life in the community, working at OHSU in psychiatry with some of the neediest folks in the community. I have the perspective of having lived in the community rather than having been in government for the last 20 years.
Okay. And Sharon.
Thank you very much. My name is Sharon Nassett, and I'm interested in Portland. I've lived here for a long time and been very active in North Portland, and I have been to council over several issues over the years, but I'm most concerned with the fact that I don't think that Portland City Council is spending the money in the correct direction. I think we should be working on our basic infrastructure, our roads, adult education, family wage jobs, and that spending our money in making us look good has ruined our infrastructure, and we've been doing that since 1982, and I would like to see us work back on enlarging the tax base so that more people have more to spend and that our city goes in that direction instead of being as indebted as we are with so much in bonds and other things.
Okay. And finally, Chris.
Thank you. My name is Chris Iverson, and I grew up in this wonderful city. I love it so very much. I have some brilliant and great ideas to bring to the city council if elected. I recently spent 7 years living in the incredible city of Amsterdam in the Netherlands, which is one of the world's greatest cities. I have a lot of really great ideas, but what I'm very much into is corporate accountability. I would like to see PGE pay their fair share in taxes so we could fund our basic infrastructure instead of taking hundreds of millions of dollars away from our economy. I'd like to see cost overruns, which happened with the tram project, never happen again. I believe my high level of integrity will filter these things out, and I can see this stuff coming. So I believe I'm an insightful and visionary person who will bring a lot of great things to city council if elected. And I love all our co-stars in this race here. I think they're all really great people, and I'm just thrilled to have them on my side.
Well, I just want to start as my host comment, that noticing that both in this race and in the race for Eric Sten's seat, that there is a lot of energy, that there's been a lot of, it seems like both of these races are galvanizing moments for a bunch of people in the community to come together and say, this is what's wrong with Portland, and we need a change in leadership. So one of the things we'll be exploring today is why four of you are here telling Dan that, telling Dan that he and probably the rest of the city council aren't doing the kind of job that you want them to be doing. I'm also kind of curious about seeing if there's any connections between some of the concerns that the opponents are representing in this race, if there's shared concerns with those who are opposing Eric Sten. I mean, I saw one sort of similarity in Sharon's statement and in the statement of Dave Lister, which has to do with millions in tax breaks for rich people in condos, or I think he talked about penthouse mansions. And so it seems like there's a perception, at least on Sharon's part, that rich people are the ones who are benefiting in the glory of what has become Portland, and that everybody else is being left behind. So that's one of the things that we want to address. I want to start, though, with Dan, looking at this, three things that come to my mind that I guess at least environmentalists would be very pleased, or two things that they were very pleased about. One, they were mixed, and one, they were opposed. And we'll start out with the thing people really liked. I think people were really happy about your strong support of the Portland Community Garden Program and expanding that into kind of like hoping to become a Portland Community Farming Program.
Our Diggable City Project.
The Diggable City Project. And the whole connection between that and the food security and being really concerned and on top of what that means and dealing with the fact that there's so many hungry people in the Portland area. A little bit more controversial, but I think that you had some support for trying to find alternatives for a East Side big pipe. Tell me if I'm correct, but it seemed that you were really wanting to go more with restoring wetlands.
Yeah, kind of a more green solutions, as we call it, you know, designed to, like, roof gardens and bioswales and things like that that keep stormwater from entering our river and polluting it.
But, in fact, it seems like that perspective has kind of been pushed aside, and we're going to have another big pipe on the East Side. Is that correct?
It hasn't been pushed aside. No, actually, we're investing a lot of money. That's one of the three cornerstones of our program to eliminate combined sewage overflows, is the green solutions. The big pipe is an indispensable part of it, though, however, also.
Right. And what's kind of funny is I had some friends when you were first running, and they said, Dan Saltzman, he's an engineer. He's going to just engineer all of our water solutions, and he's going to just put big culverts bigger and things like that. So I think in that way you have pleased some of your former opponents or critics. Good. But the third place that seemed to be the most controversial this year, got the most ink, was covering the reservoirs.
Right.
So I want to talk a little bit about if you had learned lessons from that experience, why you did it that way, and how you would counter people who would say that I think that the biggest criticism about that had to do with riding roughshod over neighborhood involvement.
Mm-hmm. You want me to start with that one?
Yeah, we'll start with the reservoirs.
Well, when I became the commissioner in charge of the Water Bureau in 2002, the city council had already decided earlier to bury the reservoirs at Mount Tabor and at Washington Park. Largely, you know, it was pretty much the aftermath of 9/11, and there was concerns about our water supply. So I inherited this decision, and I felt it was my duty as commissioner in charge of the Water Bureau to see it through. And the city council reaffirmed its support for that a number of times. Having said that, there was, as we all know, you know, significant neighborhood opposition both in Mount Tabor and in Washington Park. What I did is appoint an independent committee of citizens, and they spent probably about 6 months looking at the issue, and they came back with a recommendation that was to not to bury the reservoirs, but instead to more or less beef up security. And so that was the option that we, the city council, changed direction, and that was the option we've now embraced. However, in the meantime, a federal rule by the EPA has come out, which we anticipated the whole time, but it's now actually a final rule, and it really actually doesn't allow us to have the security option. It basically says we have to, once again, cap the reservoirs. We are challenging that rule on a couple different fronts in the court system, and you know, I support those challenges.
Now, one of the things that you were criticized for was, I think it was... typified as a no-bid contract that went out to some consultants that were ones who were studying the first stage of covering the reservoir. So why don't you let us know whether the accusations that people were saying, well, it's kind of like Halliburton, no-bid contracts. Was there any kind of, why was it a no-bid contract, and why was that money spent?
Well, there were never any contracts awarded for...
It was not for the covering, but for consulting.
Right.
Yeah.
The consultants were originally selected on a competitive basis, and as is pretty common on big projects that have several distinct phases, it's not uncommon to for a consultant to do phase one and then to be awarded administratively phase two without it going out for another competitive bid. So that's what that's all about.
Okay, well, since this is one of my most passionate interest. So that's why we're starting with the water issues. I want to go around and have each one of the other candidates talk about how you see whether you see that protecting the streams and the streamside habitat in Portland from pollutants and the whole process of greening the city, how you would deal with that, if you think it's an important issue, and how you would approach it if you were to be taking over Dancy. So we'll start with Mike.
Well, I think that Portland's moving in the right direction in many environmental issues. As far as covering the water, I think that it was just basically a catalyst from an atmosphere of fear of the things that we were going through before. I don't think that it's entirely necessary. I know that that the Portland citizens are good and very active in the neighborhoods and tend to watch people. So I think that as a community, we can safeguard and not have to spend the money on covering our water supplies.
Now, what about as far as creating the infrastructure so that most of the stormwater in the city no longer flows into our rivers and streams, but would be diverted into replications of the natural processes that water used to go through, which is to go through wetlands and other
kinds of roofs and things along those lines. I'm fully supportive of that, and I think that we're heading in the right direction as far as that's concerned. That is not necessarily a particular area that I think needs as much work. I think that we have some real business issues, and we need to grow a localized economy and things along those lines. Those are things that I'd like to focus on. We've got some real good people working on the environmental issues, and we can continue to move forward on that.
Okay. And Amanda?
Excuse me. I got my start in Portland politics 15 years ago, saving a forest at the headwaters of Arnold Creek from development and helping to pass the Metro Bond measure in 1995 so that it was able to be purchased. And then from there, I co-founded the Tryon Creek Watershed Council. I was involved in the Adventure School at Markham Elementary, which was an environmentally focused 4-8 program, it was going to be. And I helped convert a 7,000-square-foot lawn at the Markham Elementary into a native plant garden. So I've had a lot of practical experience in the neighborhoods, and that, in fact, now citywide, on green issues. From my perspective, we haven't spent enough of the big pipe money on the watershed-wide citizen involvement part, because our environment's health matters to everyone. Oregonians and Portlanders in general, we love our trees, we love our rivers and streams, and we want clean water and clean air. And we need to, the government, the city, needs to involve citizens as partners and help educate every single person about the issues of stormwater on their property. It's not something that the government can take care of with a big pipe. It's something that individuals have to make choices every day about how they live, how they manage their property, how they drive. And I think that citizen involvement component has been not as emphasized as it should be, and that's what I'll do when I'm on the council.
And we just heard from Amanda Fritz, and before that we heard from Mike Casper, and started out with Commissioner Dan Saltzman. And now we're going to hear from Sharon Nesset.
Well, thank you very much. The water issue is very large, and I would like to see us work on the money we are charged every year for having sewer flow into the river, and the EPA receives large amounts of money. Portland can recapture most of that money and money from other issues such as the brownfields and things like that to use for education and to use to take care of our water issues. And I would like to see us getting more of the money that we are paying in fines coming back. Most of the citizens that do have water on their land or near their land have that because they love it. Many of them would be happy to make more decisions and more choices that are better for the water and better for all of us. And within that decision making is the city setting up education having to do with that. And that comes from, I believe, the money that we can get back from what we are charged for the overflows and different things that are going on, and to use that money to help people do the things that they need to their land and to the property. I actually don't believe it's in our best interest to continue putting, making people, forcing people in Portland to disconnect from their original septic tanks and cesspools and all connect into one sewer system, because you do have a larger problem of overflow. And I don't think that there was that much of a problem in allowing a lot of it to seep back into the ground naturally as it was before.
Well, actually, I mean, I don't know how many people in Portland have been on septic tanks or cesspools. It's been a very, very long time. In fact, they started the disconnect program for the in East County back in the late 70s.
I'm a real estate agent, and we deal with dozens in our office a year.
Within the city limits.
Within the city limits, and I just was dealing with...
Overall, there are a small number of people that are still on septic systems.
There are entire streets.
And I know you work in North Portland, and many of those actually are in North Portland.
And southeast. And southeast. I dealt with a double-party sewer system just a couple weeks back where we had to do a second sewer line for the person that's there, and I dealt with one in January where a lady had a cesspool. And I divided her property up because she's having homes built on it, and she had to be connected, and she had a cesspool that she actually had reinstalled just 2 years earlier.
Okay. Well, we're going to continue now with Chris Iverson. We just heard from Sharon Nesset, and this is Chris Iverson now.
Thank you. Clean air and clean water is everyone's birthright. The fact we have a Superfund site here on the Willamette River at Willamette Harbor, I think, says it all. We have to be very concerned about the health of our water in this city. You know, I grew up going boating every summer on the Willamette River, and I moved to Amsterdam in 1997. When I came back in 2004, all my friends told me that it was not safe to go on the Willamette River anymore. So I think we need to take a serious look at this and spend more money to clean up our water. This is a top priority, and if we can get money from these corporations that are polluting our water, then I don't see why we can't clean it up at their expense and not at the taxpayers' expense.
Okay. I kind of want to just continue with this subject for just a little bit longer. At part, I want to sort of see if I can distinguish between Dan's and Amanda's positions. From what I'm hearing, I hear from Chris and Dan and Amanda that the water issues are really important in terms of environmental issues. From, tell me if I'm wrong, from Mike, it sounds like this is not a high priority, somebody else would do it. And from Sharon, I'm hearing that it's a financial issue and that we just have to redirect funds. But I'm still not hearing much about what ways we're actually going to deal with the concreteness of how we're going to deal with stormwater, combined sewage overflows, which are, actually we are dealing with the combined sewage overflows. That's kind of happening. But how we continue to deal with the increased amount of stormwater runoff that's going to increase as Portland grows and as you're describing how property that's being subdivided when you have a piece of property where there was one family living there and now there's five or six families, you've just sextupled or more the amount of stormwater runoff that's going to happen every time we put an impermeable surface anywhere on the property. So I kind of want to talk a little bit more about things like really it's sort of the nuts and bolts, I guess, of how we would really improve the problem here. But I guess the other part of it is, why do you, those of you who feel this is like a very, very important part of the Portland infrastructure, why do you think this is important as schools or as traffic or as other things that people raise as the big issue? So we'll start with Dan.
Well, I think first and foremost, stormwater is the single largest source of water pollution today. It's what, you know, it's not big factory pipes discharging into the Willamette anymore. It's really what washes off our streets and our roofs and our driveways that is contaminating the river. And our streams, too, that feed into the rivers, Johnson Creek, Tryon Creek, and all those. I think it's very important that we protect the quality of those creeks. We are doing, I think, a lot of innovative things. If you drive along Highway 26 these days, you'll see a lot of construction going on. What that's about is taking an old stream, Tanner Creek, and basically getting it out of the sewer system, making it a surface creek again. And that gets a lot of clean water out of the sewer system so it doesn't contribute to combined sewage overflows, and we're not spending money to send it to a sewage treatment plant. So that's one of the innovations we're doing. We also, as we talked about, we promote green roofs, and we have development codes now that require essentially that there be no net runoff, stormwater runoff on new development. New parking lots, for instance, must control all of their runoff. So I think we're doing a number of innovative things, and we've also created a green investment fund, which invests in interesting, innovative stormwater projects. And one of the things I'm personally a big fan of that I've helped promote is rainwater harvesting, using rainwater to flush toilets. A number of buildings, PSU has built a dormitory, Central City Concern has built some new housing, all of which pioneering using one of the most fundamental, simple concepts that's been around probably since the beginning of time, which is capturing rainwater and doing something better with it than putting it into your sewer system.
And something we have quite a bit of an abundance of here in Portland.
Right.
And Amanda, I'm wondering what your criticisms of what, or do you have criticisms of what the current Portland programs are, if there's ways that you see that things could be done differently or better?
Well, I was on the Planning Commission when we did the parking lot regulations for stormwater runoff, and I think they could still be stronger and there could be better language regarding the kinds of trees that we use, those kinds of things.
Could you be a little bit more specific? Actually, just as an aside, I was wandering around the Rebuilding Center in North Portland this past weekend, and they've got this amazing parking lot. And you walk on it. I was looking around, and they're talking about how they're doing all this bio-swale engineering stuff, and I thought, looks like a lot of parking lot to me. And then I looked more closely at the parking lot, and sure enough, it's permeable as opposed to impermeable. Mm-hmm. And it kind of looks like a gravel parking lot, but it's all kind of, the gravel is stuck together. So I was pretty impressed with that. So do those kinds of design methods appeal to you, or do you think that there's a lot more that needs to be done besides having like these kinds of permeable surfaces?
I don't know, but they definitely appeal, and we should be requiring them in some instances rather than just allowing them. We can do a lot better on the tree regulations. There's a group in Southwest Portland who've been analyzing the entire plethora of tree regulations across the code. There's no one single point that you can go to in the city's rules to find out what you can do with a tree on your property. And we, as a result, we don't have strong enough tree protection regulations. And the reason this is important for stormwater is that a lot of the trees capture the stormwater both in their leaves and in the uptake from their roots. And so one of the most important things people can do to help clean up the Willamette is to plant trees on their property. So I guess the main difference, certainly the city has made a lot of important progress over the last 10 years on more green solutions structurally and in the code. What I think the difference between me and Commissioner Saltzman, the approach is I'm much more interested in the participatory citizen involvement part of it, where every citizen understands and values and is assisted in being part of the solution, as well as the more engineered structural approaches, which in some cases we pay money to allow people to help people build green roofs, but there's no citizen awareness component. You can't see those green roofs. And so although they save energy, through being more efficient in terms of insulation on the roof, that's another value of them. But if people don't see it, people don't know about it, we're not building that body of awareness that I believe we need in order to continue moving forward with these approaches.
Okay, Sharon?
The fact of bringing up the money is that we lose a lot of money every year or whenever we have to pay fines that we legally can have recaptured back to deal with the exact issues that we were fined for.
Okay, I want to know.
Having to do with streams and...
Well, talk specifically, what fines are you talking about? And this is Sharon Nesset, by the way.
Oh, we are fined quite often having to do on the Willamette River with storm overflows. We also have...
Who's being fined?
The City of Portland.
The EPA, right?
Yes.
So if the City of Portland is being fined,
and instead of it going to the federal government, we can actually recapture that money through the environmental justice and use the money for education and use it for taking care of streams and property that have water on it. Right now it goes to the EPA, goes to the federal government, and stays there.
Well, my question is, how does the city council... I mean, this is a federal rule. You're trying to change a federal rule.
No, the federal rule takes the money away. We can reapply for the grants through the environmental justice and recapture the money back. It's a process that started about 5 years ago, and you can take back almost all of the money that you have to pay in federal fines, and that has to do with brownfields, it has to do with Portland Harbor, all of those things, the fines that you pay to the federal government. If you have a program in place, they will allow you to take back those fines and spend it on specific projects dealing with that issue. And those can be neighborhood issues that deal with it, as well as the general place that it happened.
Okay.
And so I would like to see our environmental justice people work on recapturing all that money and not letting it go out to the federal government.
Okay, I'm just curious, Dan, do you have any response to that? Is that something that the city council could be doing?
Well, I'm not quite sure what fines Sharon's referring to, but, I mean, we have on occasion been fined by EPA, and we're right now in a negotiation with EPA because they suddenly seem to have changed their mind about whether we're doing enough to eliminate combined sewage overflows. But there's been no resolution of that issue. And oftentimes, when we do get fined, we actually do negotiate some sort of an arrangement where we can, instead of paying the money to EPA, we can actually, you know, build more wetlands or do something to improve water quality.
So we are sort of already doing that, what she's suggesting.
Yeah, but there's not a recurring source of fines that we're paying. As I said, we are in negotiation with EPA about... there are concerns about our program, but there's been no resolution of that.
Okay. I'm gonna let, and that was Dan Saltzman, who's currently the city councilman number 3. And I'm going to let Chris Iverson respond to this, and then we will probably open up the lines to phone calls. So, Chris, what do you have? Because you talked in nice generalities about the importance of clean rivers and clean water, but I'm wondering if specifically you have any feelings about the methods that the city's used so far to deal with stormwater management and combined sewer overflows, if you have some specific vision of how you would like to see this improved.
Thank you. Well, one of the first things I did at my house is disconnect my downspouts. I think that's a very effective way to not put excess water into the Willamette River. So I would encourage more programs like that to be spread out across the city. As I'm driving around, I see about 1 in 10 houses that have done this, so the other 9 in 10 can certainly disconnect from their downspouts. I like everything Dan and Amanda have said. I think we're going in the right direction as a city, but water is a fundamental issue. It's like food, shelter, clothing. So we really need to prioritize it possibly more than we have, spend a little more money, a little more energy on it. But in general, I think we're going in the right direction, and I do agree with everything that Dan and Amanda have said.
And that was just heard from Chris Iverson, who is running for City Commission position number 3. And you are listening to KBOO Portland listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And if you're living out there in the Mid-Willamette Valley or the Columbia Gorge, I hope you can just kind of bear with us today as we deal with local Portland elections. You can laugh at us or whatever you want to do or think that we're doing things great. But anyway, I hope that you're as interested in our local issues as we probably should be as interested in yours. And I hope that we actually spend some more time in the coming future, in the near future, covering issues out in the Gorge and down the valley as well as we do here in the Portland area. So we are joined today by Dan Saltzman, who is the current holder of this position, defending his honor next Tuesday. In that ring, but there's like, I guess, six people. Are there six people running for this position? I guess seven altogether. So six running against Dan. So it's a septagonal ring that we have here. Then Mike Casper, who is the dark horse candidate who's not in the voters' pamphlet. So everything you're going to know about Chris Mike Casper, you're going to learn today. Amanda Baines.
Fritz.
From Amanda Fritz. Who is Amanda Baines? Anyway, I know. And somebody else.
I like her name, actually.
Yes, it's early.
Yeah, no, she does something totally different.
Okay. Your lawn signs are all wrong.
Oh, no.
But she's up in Washington State, so don't worry about her. Okay, Amanda Fritz, Sharon Nassett, and Chris Iverson. And we also are taking phone calls, and the number to call if you want to join the conversation is 503-231-8187. It's about 6 minutes after 8 o'clock. We do have a caller, and then we're going to get back. And I'm going to be taking actually relatively few calls today because we have so little time, less than an hour, to get all these positions hashed out. So when you do call, please make your point very briefly, and then we'll get you off the phone, and we'll have the contestants here respond to what you say. So, hello, you're on the air.
Is that me?
It's you.
Okay. Are you taking non-infrastructure questions?
Non-infrastructure. We're taking questions of anything to do with people, with what City Commissioner number 3 will be dealing with in the coming 4 years.
Okay. Well, here's the question I have. I would like to hear the candidates comment on drug testing for the police, who are not drug tested at all in the city, even after a gun-involved incident.
Okay.
Or for steroids or drugs or alcohol.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'm going to put that kind of on the queue of questions to ask, but I have my own questions, and we're only through the first one. So we'll just try to include that towards the end. So thanks for calling. But what I want to get down to next, it has to do, actually, Amanda, you had something you wanted to say.
I just had a couple of comments. Okay. One, we should recognize that in East County, their stormwater goes into the ground and that they've been waiting for relief for sewer charges, stormwater fees for a long time. And that there are different areas of the city. Some are in the combined sewer system, some are dumping stormwater into streams, and some are not contributing to the stormwater issue. And we need to be fair to all citizens in that process. The second point I just wanted to comment on is that this position number 3 race has been very much more congenial than the position number 2 race, that we consider ourselves running for the seat rather than against Dan. And so we're not really contestants or combatants. We are here to say what we think and to be participants.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I've also seen it in the lawn signs. I mean, I was looking at there's a lot of Dave Lister lawn signs in my neighborhood, and I'm like, you know, a little bit appalled every time I go by them, because I do think it's injecting a certain kind of nastiness that we're seeing in the gubernatorial race. I mean, we're seeing that a lot, but it is kind of... But I do think, I mean, and I'm very unhappy that the race against Eric Sten has taken the tone that it has, because I think that we're very fortunate to have the city council that we have. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've lived here a long time, and this last city council came in 2 years ago. It's the first time I'm kind of looking at it and going, oh, this is like representing me, which is kind of a very nice feeling. Now, there may be a few, what is it, 12% of or 18% of Portland who doesn't listen to cable. No, I think it's a little bit bigger part of that. But there's a small minority of Portlanders who probably feel like they're really being left behind, and they could relate to the way city council was 30 or 35 years ago. But for those of us who are really concerned, particularly about environmental issues, I think
and a lot of social justice issues as well. I think that we are pretty happy with a lot of the directions they're going in, and so now we're getting into the fine-tuning, and that's kind of how I see this. Before we move out off of water and into density, I just wanted to ask, Mike, since you said that the water issues weren't something that you were that concerned about, and after hearing these conversations, I'm wondering if you do feel that or appreciate that protecting the watershed that we're on in this region is kind of one of the vital core principles of having a healthy, livable, productive, working city.
Well, maybe it's important that I restate myself. I understand the incredible value of our water and how important it is for our city. But everyone's got things that they're focused on and they're good at. And I understand that Portland is, as we've been talking, heading in the right direction. We've got some great people working on these jobs and keeping this moving forward. I'm just saying that I'm going to bring other issues that are important to my constituents. That would be the low income, the middle class, the ones that are being nickel and dimed by these businesses across town or being nickel and dimed by the system that we're living in, and we just need some voice, and that's why I'm here. I'm talking about employee ownership of businesses, restructuring, you know, rebuilding our local economy and keeping the money in here, keeping it here with the city. So I'm hugely interested in the importance and the prospects of continuing this process of improving our environment here locally in our backyards. I'm also saying that my expertise and my skills come from a different area.
Okay, well, I want to talk now about kind of urban planning issues. And Amanda lists as part of her prior governmental experience being on the Portland Planning Commission for 15 years.
Seven years.
Okay, 96 to 2003. So 7 years. And during some very critical times when Portland was going through some major transitions. And Dan, I know that one of the places that you stand up has to do a whole lot with the way our city is being designed. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about an issue that has become kind of contentious, or a general theme, which has to do with increasing density in Portland. We are being told that our population is going to grow it's going to double, I think, or something in the next 30 years. It sort of keeps changing. And so there's two parts to this question. One is, do we want to continue to encourage the kind of growth that's happening in Portland by believing that we can plan for it and we can design a city that will remain a livable city and that protects farmland on the outside and all the principles that we've supposedly been living by for the last 30 years? Or is there some concern about maybe figuring out ways to not encourage Portland to grow so much? And the other part of it has to do with the move towards density in urban neighborhoods. And I know that on the west side, or on the close-in west side, density is being touted as the answer to everything, and with the South Waterfront development and with the kind of developments that are happening in northwest Portland, particularly in the Pearl. On the east side, density is not quite as pleasing a concept. So I wanted to talk about, do we need to be making our neighborhoods, building more densely in the core of the city? Are there options to that? So why would you propose density, or why would you argue against it? We'll start with Dan. And what does density mean, too? I mean, that's the other part of it, because people say density, like it's because this big buzzword. I know my neighborhood was fighting against density 13 years ago, and a lot of us who were fighting against it then are kind of realizing that we were fighting against something that was over there, and what's really happening is looking, you know, turning around going, oh, this is what we really need to do. So what does density mean to you?
Well, I think, I guess technically the engineer in me says it's the number of people per square mile. But I think what density really means is that we adhere to the notion that we relish a livable city, but we also relish an urban growth boundary where we live and work on one side of that boundary and where we have farm, forest, and recreation opportunities on the other side of that boundary. And in order to adhere to that concept, which every city in Oregon must do, thanks to, some pioneering work of our legislature in the 1970s. We have to focus on developing areas along, particularly along major transit corridors, there will be more dense development. But we also have to, work hard to preserve the livability of each individual neighborhood. Every neighborhood has its own unique characteristics. But I also think that we want to encourage neighborhood business centers as well, so people can, not have to get in their car as much to go and get, the bottle of orange juice. They can shop, eat, shop, and do whatever they can closer to home too. Farmers markets. I mean, that you asked about the Diggable City project earlier. One of those goals is to encourage more farmers markets throughout the city as well.
But not only that, I mean, because this is the other side. I mean, I know Mike Houck has a famous quote. I'm not sure he made it himself, but he's been sprouting it around the region, which is in livable cities is protection of the wild. The idea being that we have to create livable cities if we're going to protect wilderness outside of cities. And one of the goals that Mike Houck has had is to protect nature in the city. So what does that play in? And particularly when we're talking about redeveloping or re-engineering how we relate to our rivers and this concept of like renaturalizing the banks of the rivers, how do we use the watersheds within our region as kind of a infrastructure for creating what Mike calls the green infrastructure, but the right. natural infrastructure of the city?
Right. Well, I mean, what Mike has been a leader on is exactly what I embrace, is exactly that. We are, for instance, in the South Waterfront neighborhood, we are in the process of developing a new, bigger greenway trail. We are totally redoing the bank of the river there.
And how wide is that greenway trail going to be?
75 feet.
And it was actually originally, they wanted it to be 150.
75 to 100 feet. It,
okay.
Is, yeah.
With encroachments.
So anyway, the stream banks, or the river bank in that case, is going to be totally redone to be more natural, to mimic basically our natural environment pre-development, which is good both for salmon who are trying to go upriver, but it's also, it makes the waterfront indeed more accessible. And all of our watersheds in Portland are very important, and we have been doing exactly what Mike Houck is suggesting, is using, in Johnson Creek, for instance, we have purchased land under a willing seller program that historically floods, and the idea is to use that property to do what it was intended to do, and that is to absorb rainwater and prevent flooding by letting the rainwater basically reside there and percolate into the ground. So, you know, I'm pleased. You know, Mike Houck is a supporter of mine, and I listen to him a lot, whether I like to or not. He's very persistent.
Well, as another aside, I'll throw this out for the outside of the west side and close southeast area, which gets most of the political attention. I was visiting out at Zenger Farm a couple weeks ago, which is on the Johnson Creek watershed area, and you look across, and there's this vast expanse of fields and woods and a few houses, some of which are going to come down because that's all the area that's been the willing sellers have sold back to the city, and it's all becoming kind of naturalized.
Right.
And so would you say that that's a way in which we're not just imposing density everywhere? Because I know one of the areas that's very nervous about density is that very area around Johnson Creek.
Sure, we don't want density in the floodplain. And Zenger Farms is a great example where the city, you know, teamed up with some nonprofit organizations to make a living working farm in the city limits of Portland. But you're right, that land you looked at is land that we have purchased primarily for its open space values, but as importantly for its floodwater storage capacity. And, you know, homes that have been built there in the past and the ones that are coming down are the ones that historically flood. And so we're trying to do that in a very comprehensive manner.
And that was Dan Saltzman, who is currently commissioner number 3 for the city council. Now, Mike Casper, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I think that this kind of brings us to the point. If we can get away from the water and get back to the density, or that is people that are coming here to Portland to live, our job economy is not supporting it, and yet they're still coming. I think I can make a point here is the way that we're using this density and the land as far as building the waterfront properties where you've got million-dollar condos, as we see my constituents and my neighbors moving further and further away from their jobs as they're being gentrified and pushed out as capital is brought into poor neighborhoods, so to speak. And that is initially why, or that's one of the reasons that I'm doing this for my constituents, is that we need a voice to say, no, we don't need million-dollar skyrises down on the waterfront. And the Pearl District is beautiful, and I'm glad that we have it, but we need affordable housing. I mean, we can't keep pushing people out. Density is about people. And when we use words like density and urban growth boundaries, what we tend to forget is that there are people that are living there that need help and that need affordable housing and property and you know, utilities, all the things that are nickeling and diming us. And rather than building expensive condos that only a select few can afford, we need to start building high-density, affordable housing that we can all afford.
Now, one question is, how do you build high-density, affordable housing that is not instant slums? They did that in New York in the turn of the 20th century, and they turned into some of the most miserable slums
anywhere in the world. So how do you create high density affordable housing, which is going to be livable housing?
Well, that's the idea. I don't think that it's a new one. I think that we have people that are working on it. It's changing the model, having new ideas and looking at new ways of building. The contractors and the ones that build are the last that are going to want to change their practices. But that's where the leadership in City Hall comes in. We set the standards on which they need to.
And how do you get the money to support that?
Well, it seems to me that we've already got it. We've got the money to be the developing, because the developing, it continually happens. It's what are we developing and what are we creating? And we need more of a choice saying, rather than expensive condos, we need you to build some affordable housing.
Okay, but the problem is that when they build us expensive condos, they get paid for them by the people who buy them. So if we're going to basically have subsidized housing, where's the money going to come to subsidize the housing?
Well, we're already subsidizing them to build it. I mean, we give them the tax incentives and the breaks in order to get that initial upfront to help them build the buildings that they would like. And well, how about this? The percentage of affordable housing in their units needs to increase. How about that? We ask for more responsibility from them. Okay, maybe it's utopian for me to believe that affordable housing for everyone, but it's not utopian for me to believe that we can hold these contractors with a higher standard of building practices. You know, 3%, 4%, 8% is not enough housing. How about 10%, 20%, 30% of your housing? And then if the wealthy still want to live above me, that's fine with me. If they want to pay $1 million, as long as I have affordable housing for my kids.
Okay. And Amanda? That was, we just heard from
Mike Casper.
Okay.
We need homes for families in neighborhoods, and we need homes that families can enjoy living in neighborhoods. So one of our problems is that we have more houses, but fewer people living in them, and we have these major structures where families don't want to live because there aren't the schools in the neighborhood, there aren't the parks. And we can add density without destroying our neighborhoods, and that there hasn't been enough focus on that over the past 10 years.
And how do we do that?
Well, in accessory dwelling units, which we did while I was on the Planning Commission, which is otherwise known as granny flats, we have small apartments or small homes in people's backyards. We've added 4,000 homes over the past several years in neighborhoods, and most people don't even know where they are. They haven't caused problems. You know, compare that with the thousands of homes going up in South Waterfront, which everybody can see, and which are going to cause some significant traffic problems. The other things that we do is, when we did the St. John's Plan, I advocated on the Planning Commission for not changing the zoning on some small single-family homes where some families, some of the recently immigrated families who have large extended families living in a small house were living. If we change that to apartment zoning, we get more units, but we're going to get much less density because those families aren't going to live there.
Well, actually, I know that Portland used to have much higher density with fewer houses than we have now because people, well, this is one of the things. People, like I live in a 2,000 square foot house. There's two of us. Well, that house probably in 1950 had five or six family members of one family living in that house. And at Portland, I heard a figure that, 80% of Portlanders don't have children or something. I forget what it is. But
so we have to look for ways for doing more internal conversions. And when we do build, we need to be sure that we add the parks, the sidewalks, the transit that makes it livable. In South Waterfront, those greenway improvements, they're going to cost $35 million. We only have $6 million funded so far. And the council voted to take money from the parks pool in Northwest Portland and use it to buy the property in South Waterfront instead of making sure that that was prioritized in the urban renewal district in South Waterfront. Development needs to pay its way.
Okay, and that was Amanda Fritz, and now we're going to hear from Sharon Nassett.
Thank you. I have been looking at what's been going on in the housing for quite a while, and it is not just one issue. There are several issues. One is we need to be focusing on lifestyle change homes. We have a lot of elderly people and people that tend to live in a house, and it becomes dilapidated. They become isolated. The house is underutilized, but we're not offering homes in the same neighborhood that would attract them to leave their house, so they sit there and the house stays off the market. By looking at lifestyle change homes inside each of our neighborhoods, then people will not be leaving the neighborhood when they decide that their needs are no longer good or they no longer need a large house. They can stay right there in the neighborhood, move right up the street. We're also not looking at putting entry-level housing in all ends of town. We tend to pack entry-level housing, first-time homes, in specific areas, which means when that person loves that neighborhood and they want to stay there, they look around and all there are entry-level housing. So they take the money and they leave. What happens is it continually keeps the neighborhood in flux of people that are moving in that have no money. And as they move up and they start having children and would like to stay in the neighborhood and have more money to spend in the neighborhood, there's no housing available for them. By focusing on continuing putting entry-level housing or first-time house in specific areas, it causes gentrification by doing that. The other thing that we have to look at, as Amanda said, is accessory housing. It's very expensive to turn your basement, your garage, and your attic into a new unit or home. But it gives the person funds that's there. It utilizes the house fully. And it makes the neighborhood that is well established and there not change as much because you do not notice the difference. The last thing that we also need to look at is we have almost 1,000 towns in Oregon that are dying from lack of people being there. Those towns have infrastructure, roads, and schools. A lot of people would like to live in those small towns instead of necessarily living here in Portland. By looking outside our urban growth boundary and into their areas and helping them with the little bit of economics they need to have companies that provide 15 and 20 people jobs that a community can live off of, and therefore people who are more interested in moving into those areas instead of necessarily moving to Portland. By not having a good economy base outside of Portland that supports people staying in those areas, they tend to move here looking for a job and are often underskilled. It increases our base of underskilled labor and brings down our wages and causes more problems. So by looking at it in a more holistic manner of accessory units, looking at the a million square feet that we have downtown of buildings upstairs that are available and should be revamped for housing, looking at lifestyle change housing, looking at where we're putting our entry-level housing, and then looking outside our urban growth boundaries for areas where people, they want to be in Portland because they love it, that's one thing. But those people that would enjoy being in a small community or would like to stay in the community they grew up in but cannot because of financial opportunity, that's another way to look at what we do with our density. It does not all have to be in our own backyard.
Okay, because you say in your voters pamphlet, high density is ruining our neighborhoods and overloading our streets. So, I mean, in your statement
yes.
there, it sounds like you're pretty much opposed to density within most neighborhoods in Portland.
I'm opposed to the way we're doing density. I wrote an article a few years back in North Portland. They were trying to rezone both sides of Lombard and everything in St. John's on one side and pack in high density. And
now, what is high density? That's where I get...
The high density they were talking
about
at that time were... they were talking about upping the... I think it's by acreage, and I think they were talking about upping it to 65 people in a block, and the block before was 22. And I'll have to look back to see if those are the exact numbers, but I think a block had like 22 or a quarter of a block, and the number it went up to was 65. So it was a little over three times, almost four times the amount of people that were originally there in what was being proposed at that time. And if they were going to be doing something for our sidewalks, our schools, the pools that we've had out there closed down, the lack of community centers we don't have, we lost our Y. Well, then there's a difference. And if you're out in Hillsboro and you go to get a community large apartment complex, usually there's a game room. Usually there's facilities and things with it. When we're adding all these apartments in, we aren't asking them to do any kind of amenities that you would have when you're outside. And having those type of things built in, although they are expensive, is one of the ways that you can look at density. So density, it depends on how you're doing it. When you're just packing people in, North Portland has a huge amount. You can almost not turn one block and not see a skinny lot.
Yeah, though actually, I mean, I was wandering around Mississippi Street, and there's an awful lot of empty lots there. I'd say about a quarter of the property.
Yes,
and that's one of the, you know, redeveloping, booming little commercial centers.
If you head out though towards Pheasant and St. John's, you can't find a vacant lot hardly. And you'll see block after block after block of the skinny lot houses that have been built with no place in front to park because they did not put their parking driveways together so that their green space is together, and have little or no planning. Every time they have an opportunity to lop off a piece of land, they do. And that is why so many people have been upset. And as you probably saw polls, when I went out and polled my neighborhood by standing on corners and handing out 450 things, in the 80% came back that they were tired of skinny lot houses and they were tired of the density and that they thought it was being handled inappropriately. Not that they didn't want more citizens there. As you said, there used to be larger families in larger areas, and it does make a good buying power. But it is how they're doing the houses and the type of homes that they're putting up.
Okay, and I want to give Chris an opportunity. This is Chris Iverson.
Thank you. There's a lot of really great ideas in this room I'm hearing. I really appreciate all of those. They say our population is going to double within 30 years. That's at the current rate of growth. I believe it's going to be much greater than that, and we need to definitely plan for that. I don't see anything wrong with development or growth as long as it's done in a sustainable way. And we need to take a look at the properties within the urban growth boundary and possibly do some mixed-use buildings. There's a young couple I was just reading about that has created a new model of a live-work building where people can live and work in a building. They share restrooms. So this is a new model that we need to take a look at and replicate all around the city. In addition to that, I think the South Waterfront development is fine because they did it in an industrial area. They didn't take a forest and cut it down and build these condos. They did it in a heavily polluted, toxic area of the city that needed to be cleaned up for a long time. That was like the armpit of Portland before now. Now it's going to be a shining example of what Portland is. Now, the only thing I would suggest is that beforehand in planning, they should have planned it a little more sustainably, should have included a little more affordable housing, but the developers seem to be on the right track. They have some good ideas. They just needed a little bit more of the sustainability ideas. But I think we just need to take a look at the properties we have within the urban growth boundary and develop them in a wiser, more sustainable way. And as we're moving the urban growth boundary out, all development should be sustainable.
Well, I wanted to, that was Chris Iverson. Dan Sussman, I want to give you an opportunity to respond, particularly to what Sharon Nassett was saying. I'm a little sort of curious about what your position is about density, specifically about the skinny lot houses, which was I know has been pretty controversial, and also about the amount of affordable housing that's been included in the South Waterfront redevelopment, and perhaps, because I understand that there was going to be more affordable housing than it looks like it's going to be happening now, so why it's turning the way it is and how you feel about that.
Okay. Now, let me just respond to one thing Chris just said about sustainability in the South Waterfront. South Waterfront is really a model for sustainability. OHSU is building the Center for Health and Healing, I believe is what it's called, is seeking very close to getting the platinum green building standard. And one of the things they're doing, very innovative, is actually they are actually capturing all their sewage and treating it on the building. So they're not even putting anything into the sewage system whatsoever. We're also investing a lot in creative ways to control stormwater runoff and keep it from getting into the river. So there's a lot of good stuff going on there, and we're extending the streetcar. As to the skinny lot issue, you know, I know that's it's been a real flashpoint in neighborhoods, and I think what we did was we basically had a design competition. We had an international design competition for skinny lot houses. I mean, I do think they fill a role. They are an affordable product that some people need and want. So we had a design competition, got designs from all over the world. We selected, I think, four or five that were sort of, you know, the winners, and if builders choose to use those designs, basically they get extreme reduced discounts on their permit fees, and they basically get handed sort of the building plans and the specs right away. And I think everybody who, if you take a look at these designs, you'll I think everybody will agree they're good designs.
Well, I guess that Sharon,
that has now happened because of the fact that so many people have come and complained. At the look at the houses,
right.
It was complaint driven, and this is about 5 years into skinny, 4 or 5 years into skinny lots, and I do appreciate, and as Amanda said, it has nothing to do with Dan Saltzman, fine gentleman, has worked very, very hard. It's that we each have a different vision and ideas of how we'd like to see Portland go further, and I am appreciative of the fact that when so many people came down there and complained as loudly as they did about the looks of these homes and snout houses and stuff, that council did, or the planning division, whether it was council or not, did go forward and make changes that have made things better. And I think that that there are plenty of things that we can do to continue along those lines.
Let's recognize, though, that it was the citizens who got that done. It was 24 neighborhoods going into city council. It was Eric Sten changing his vote to do that. And the fundamental problem with skinny lots is that it's not fair to allow areas of the city that have this historical double zoning to develop at twice the density without looking at providing parks, sidewalks, transit. The problem with skinny lots is not just the way the houses look. It's that the area is not zoned for that amount of density. And if we want people to accept density, we have to do it in a way that's fair, that's predictable, and that provides the services at the same time so that people know what to expect and so that neighborhoods retain their character. That's what zoning is supposed to do.
Well, and that's very true. We have large parts of Northeast where people cannot rezone their property when you're off of 48th and Lombard Court and things like that, where their property is 150 wide and 250 back, and it would be perfect to make a little alleyway back and to build homes and things behind it, and people would like to do that, but they can't because they're not zoned smaller. And then other parts of house, as you said, we're historically zoned in 25 by 100 lots, and that we have large areas of town that weren't, and we haven't in a major comprehensive way looked at all of it and said, okay, should we equally, as Amanda said, put forth something, and that would really help because there are large lots all over Northeast that could be divided, and yet you come into some areas that are an older town like North Portland or some places in Southeast that were plotted a long time ago by 25 by 100, and they're feeling a very large impact. And it
25 by 100? It sounds like a very small lot.
Yes, it's a historical lot pattern from 100 years ago. So there's no, it makes no sense to allow today's homes to be built 15 foot wide on those lots. We should do a comprehensive look and be fair.
And that was done at the turn of the century or before when they were looking at houses from the East Coast, the brownstones that were attached. And so the 25 by 100 sounded quite nice. And so they went through it, and there are large sections of town. But then when you go into all other parts of towns that weren't originally little towns that were established that way, you will find that they have lot patterns that are very, very large and can't be split up.
Well, actually, I want to get to another point here that I'm curious. I want to hear Dan's response about the because Sharon brought up an interesting issue about, it seems like our housing patterns are segregated, so starter homes are in certain neighborhoods, more affluent homes are in other neighborhoods, and people, basically, it seems that we don't have a nice mix of housing throughout the city in all different neighborhoods, so that somebody can buy a house, let's say, in the neighborhood that they grew up in, or a neighborhood that they really fall in love with, that they can afford, and then if they want to move into a larger house later on, they have to move someplace else. Is that a pattern that you see? It's actual, and what would you see could be done to address that?
Well, you know, that kind of picks up on a point that Mike and both of you said earlier about, you know, affordable housing. You know, we need to have more family-friendly, affordable housing that has, you know, at least three bedrooms. And we need to have the ability, as Sharon was saying, for people to remain in their neighborhood when they no longer want to live necessarily in a big house. And that's, you know, and it's good to kind of have that turnover. We want people to be able to live in their neighborhood, but by the same token, we want to free up some of those larger houses so that families with children can live in them. And that's very important, not only for intrinsically who we are as a city, but it's very important to our schools as well. But affordable housing, you know, is not going to be monolithic. It's not going to be high rises like you mentioned on the East Coast that have, you know, been massive failures. It's going to be things like, you know, mixed income units where you have some high income units, but you also have low income units living in the same building. People should, you know, not be segregated by their income level. We firmly believe in that, and we encourage that type of affordable housing in the city.
But how, because that's been a big issue at South Waterfront, that it seems like there was a much larger percentage that was going to be set aside originally for affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I may be confusing things, but it seems like some of the problems with the tram overrun, cost overruns, and some other issues of other cost overruns have really narrowed the amount of affordable housing that's going to be available in South Waterfront. Is that correct?
No, I mean, the recent development agreement that we executed, you know, the one that most people know about, the increased money we committed to the tram, but it also includes increased money for affordable housing, you know, increased money for building the neighborhood park sooner. And it accelerates the schedule for the affordable housing to be constructed. So there actually is, a significant amount of affordable housing. Now, I won't kid you. I mean, it's not going to be the predominant housing type in South Waterfront. But again, there is going to be affordable housing. And the City Council just last week or 2 weeks ago, we passed a resolution that, calls on the PDC to dedicate 30% of urban renewal money to affordable housing throughout the city.
Will there be teeth to that? And PDC seems to run off on its own plan. So,
we're working on that, the City Council, yeah.
Because, just a minute, could I just respond to that? Because at the hearing, after Dan had announced he was changing his vote to, Dan announced the week before that he was going to vote for $5 million more money for the tram. And at the hearing after that, Michael Anderson of the Community Development Network said that, in fact, in the new development agreement, there are fewer affordable housing units required than in the previous one. So it's that, and that, there was no response to that at the public hearing. So, and also he pointed out, as did Eric Sten in his closing comments, that the city is now paying $5 million for half a piece of the property that 2 years ago cost $3 million. So there's a $3.5 million markup on this property that, again, is coming from that urban renewal district. There was no response to that.
I think if you check out the latest development agreement, you will see there is a higher commitment and a sooner commitment to build affordable housing in South Waterfront.
So Michael Anderson and the Community Development Network were wrong?
I believe so.
But then one other thing before, and then I'll let Mike Casper have a word or two. I know that this is a surprising number of affordable housing units in the Pearl. I mean, it's sort of, I think, a well-kept secret. But my concern there is that there's no affordable place to shop. So, that's, I mean, it's all great to have, affordable housing. I mean, there's reasons why there are so few children living in the Pearl. But, I mean, if the only place you can shop for food is Whole Foods.
Well, actually, there is a Safeway being built on Lovejoy.
There's one up on 10th, too.
That's not really close to the Pearl. I mean, even though it's only, 10, 15 blocks away, when you're downtown, it feels further away. And it's across Burnside. It's like a whole other...
But, just last Saturday, I attended a... sort of a public workshop about how the Pearl can become more family friendly. And, certainly affordable housing is a huge issue, but there are other things too that came up during this workshop. And it was very interesting because, surprisingly, most people think there aren't families with children there, but there are a few, trailblazers there who do, want to live in that urban environment.
Pioneering families.
Right. They want to live in that urban environment. They want to raise kids there. And,
that kind of remind me of the pioneering plants at Mount St. Helens, I mean, it's like they're hanging on there, but the nutrition is really hard to get and you have to kind of dig your roots really deep. So you have to go all the way up to Trader Joe's basically to find.
Right. We have some nice parks in the Pearl District, but certainly we need, there's surprisingly a lack of any kind of three bedroom units regardless of what the price is. There's nothing that's really three bedrooms. I was startled to learn that, but there are other amenities and things that we can be doing to make the Pearl more amenable to families.
So I'm also concerned,
but there is going to be a Safeway, like I said, on about 12th and Lovejoy.
That's good, I guess, if you like Safeways. But the other part of it is with the South Waterfront, are there being steps made to not repeat some of the problems of the Pearl? I mean, the Pearl, in many ways, has been a very successful experiment, but I think the fact that families, in general, have a hard time living there is an indication that there's some things wrong.
Well, I was the deciding vote against a tax abatement for a building in South Waterfront. The purpose of the tax abatement was to encourage affordable housing. I voted against it because all the affordable units, all 48 of them, were going to be studios. And I said, well, there's nothing family-friendly about that, so I was a... But deciding vote against that tax abatement, and we since have placed a moratorium on that whole program until we can figure out if we're going to reinstitute it, how do we do it to encourage family-friendly housing.
Okay, that was Dan Saltzman. And Mike Casper, you had a comment.
Dan just pretty much got to the point before I did. Affordable housing, an 800-square-foot studio for, almost $900 is not affordable. Defining the terms of affordable, we're building them and we give them tax abatements, or in this case, we pull them because what they provide is just not adequate. Who's really going to be, who's that really, the studio is really going to be a helping as far as affordable housing goes.
Okay. I wanted to get into a whole, because we only got about another 15 minutes left. I want to talk about money and the campaign. And so I guess I want to ask Dan, who controls you? I mean, because I think there's a perception, and this is one of the things that I get a sense that most of the people in this room are running against you on the issue of basically who has the say in how our cities run. And the city council certainly feels a lot more transparent than it did 15 years ago. but there's still, I've had conversations with several elected office holders who tell me that if you don't get money from real estate interests and developers in the local elections, you just don't get elected. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, either how do you get money from those people and not be beholden to them totally, or how do you find other source ways to fund your campaign so that everybody will feel like they can have access to your office once you're elected, as opposed to the people with the big money that...
Well, I would say, you know, first of all, it's you know, who owns me are ultimately the voters. I mean, the voters are going to cast their votes. It'll be counted on next Tuesday, and they're the ones that decide, you know, who's going to be in this office. And I've had a record of 13 years as a county commissioner and a city commissioner, which I believe my record of independence and doing the right thing speaks for itself. And if anybody reviews my record and thinks I'm beholden to somebody, you know, I would challenge them to point to where that is. I think I've equally offended just about everybody that's ever contributed to my campaigns at some point or another. I think people contribute to me because they like, you know, they like my independence, they like my commitment to the environment, to families and children, and to, you know, keeping an eye on the bottom line of government.
Okay. Mike?
Dan's just using the old school method. Here in Portland, we've got the voter-owned elections, which was, I think, a huge stimulus for the disenfranchised and the alienated. I know that it's one of the main reasons that I decided to get involved, because it gave me and the my constituents and the views that I hold close an opportunity to be heard. And I don't think that there's really any way to prove or disprove whether or not somebody has influence from the money. But if you just take it down to a very basic level, if you owe, you owe, and people are eventually going to want favors in return. And I think the best thing that can happen for our politics is to continue moving forward with the voter-owned election idea, where if you've got 1,000 people that can support you and a good message, you collect the money, and then you're funded, and you don't have to worry about individual business influences, because I had enough trouble getting $5 contributions, and they wanted to know everything that I was going to do in City Hall for that $5. Now, I imagine that if I was given $10,000, that I would have the same concerns, but I would want a little bit more special attention. Maybe not mention my name out in front, but hey, listen, I need this contracting, you know, I'm running a tight bid with somebody else. You know, what can you do for me if you want to be reelected next year? You're going to need my bling. So if you don't have it, then you know, you're indebted whether or not you want to. Your independence, I think, is dramatically challenged, as well as the integrity can go along with it, because you're beholden to a system in which you're constantly fundraising from the same people.
Okay, Amanda?
Well, this is another of the core differences between the challengers and the incumbent. And nobody has given $25,000 to me for my campaign. Nobody has even given me $500. The most I've accepted is $5 from anybody. I'm very proud to be the first candidate to qualify under the voter-owned election system. We did it as honorably as it could possibly be done. We collected $5 from 1,000 people who live in Portland. I didn't take any money from anybody who doesn't live in Portland. Dan's contributions have about 50 people who don't live in Portland, some of whom don't even live in the state, who are contributing to his reelection. I think it's important that the voters own the election, because those are the folks who are going to get out and vote by Tuesday, and the citizens own the elected officials, that everybody in Portland is contributing 30 cents to my campaign. And so when I'm elected to office, everybody has equal right of access, and I will listen to everybody, and nobody will have to even wonder whether I'm beholden to special interests, because the people who matter in my campaign are the people who vote and the people who've been volunteering to help me get elected. And I'm just really excited about the voter-owned election system in general, because it means that anybody has the option and a real opportunity, not just a token voice, but a real voice, that if you can show that you're organized and have the leadership to collect those 1,000 donations, which was really difficult to do, as evidenced by the fact that I'm now the only community candidate who's not an incumbent to be certified as a voter-owned elections candidate. If you can show that you can do that, then you can get to the stage, and that means that anybody who has the community experience and the leadership can be a viable candidate for city council and have the money to get my message out.
Yeah, interestingly, one of the opponents, or one of the candidates for this race, who's not here, listened to Tate, was, I think, part of a scandal around the misuse of the voter-owned elections.
Well, again, let me just advocate for the position 3 race, because we all, there were originally 10 of us, and I think every one of the 10 candidates has behaved honorably, and we have contributed to the civic debate rather than turning people off. Lucinda made a mistake at the end, but Lucinda worked very hard knocking on doors from September through March to raise the 550 donations that she raised by herself. And knowing how hard that was, I can understand how somebody at the end would be convinced by somebody who they had checked out at the auditor's office to ask, you know, is this person for real? Can I trust these donations? And the auditor's office said that there were no problems with the previous filing.
And then the auditor's office learned otherwise about the previous filing.
Well, indeed filing. So. We've all learned through this process. Yeah. The great thing about voter-owned elections is that it's transparent. Those problems have come up quickly. They've been easily found out, and we can improve the system. There's a citizen commission that's going to be updating it after this election. It's really good that we're not voting on it right now because it's obviously a work in progress, but it's part of the excitement of Portland is that we can have this new system.
And that was Amanda Fritz, and now we're going to hear from Sharon Nassett.
Well, I believe that when you look at Dan and other people that are on council, that they are honestly trying to follow what they feel is best. You do feel a little bit from somebody that has helped you a lot, but you still, when you have integrity, such as most of the people that we have elected to office over the years, you still have within you what you know you believe, and you just have to push back. It is something that people that are our leaders are capable of doing. But what I would like to really talk about is the voter-owned election helped with the money part. The problem in Portland is the media part and the groups and organizations who choose and pick who they allow to be heard. Instead of having the viableness of a candidate be decided in the primary by official candidates all being treated the same and setting up a process where people are treated the same, you have things like the City Club of Portland kept me out of two of their debates.
Yeah, they also snubbed me as well.
Myself
the
included.
The Bus Project, when they did the Candidates Gone Wild for teaching democracy, would not allow me to participate.
Yeah, they also snubbed me.
I think they always get the top two challengers, though.
Well, but it's not for them to decide. The viableness of a candidate needs to be heard for the value of Portland. Concordia Neighborhood Association did not invite me. Concordia Neighborhood Association did not invite Gary Hansen, a representative of the state who has served us for years and years, and when he kept insisting, they canceled the candidate forum he was having. The Northwest Neighborhood Examiner did the same thing where I had to stand up, and then the newspaper says, she shows up early, stays late, talks to everybody, listens to what's said, and even has the nerve to show up to all the debates she's not invited to. Well, why are we allowing that? That is a larger issue, because throwing money at a situation isn't the answer. How about making an equal process and setting up an endorsement form and setting up a ABC type of form where you know that everybody's invited or not? This is what will bring integrity to the process, not necessarily money. Amanda has done a nice job, but the fact is for the viability and for the future of Portland, it is in the best interest to hear what all of us have to say. And as for affordable housing, if we had really good jobs, we wouldn't have to be giving out affordable housing. People would have affordable housing on their own.
Okay, and that was Sharon Nassett. I will say that KABU is committed to having every candidate on, which is why
I know, I
we
appreciate it.
We can't even barely fit in this room, but we're
I
doing
appreciate
it. When we had the 17 people running for mayor a few years ago, we had them all on, too.
Congratulations. Good job.
Congratulations.
I'm not sure we had the actual... I don't think Vera Katz came. okay, and finally, Chris Iverson.
Voter-owned elections puts the purity back in politics, and that's why I love the program so much, and I love Amanda for qualifying. You know, I think there's a stark difference between Jenny Burdick, who is obviously a puppet or a stooge of these corporations that are controlling Portland for so long, and Dan Saltzman. Dan is far more independent, even though he does take a few corporate contributions. So I think that, you know, voter-owned elections could be the answer. It could create such a shift in the future that most candidates, even the incumbents, would choose to engage in the process, and that would completely level out and even out the election. So I think we need to go in that direction and, you know, expose people like Jenny Burdick for who they are, corporate puppets.
Okay, actually, in the last, I want to apologize to the listeners who are on hold, because it looks like we're not really going to be able to take calls today, because there's too many people in the room. We'll all have things to say, so we'll be taking calls. Next week, we'll have a totally different subject, of course. So I apologize for those of you who've been hanging on the line. I want to ask one more question, which I think is going to take us to the end of the show. A number of cities around the country have been voting resolutions opposing going to war in Iraq or calling for our troops to come be pulled out. And I'm wondering what each one of your positions would be on this. We've sort of had a situation like this before we went to war in Iraq. I remember, Dan, that you, I think, voted against the resolution. So
I actually wasn't at that meeting, but I would have voted against it. Yes.
Okay. So I want to know how each one of you would vote if we were to have, as I think people are talking about putting a resolution before the city council, would you vote to support a resolution to pull out our troops from Iraq and perhaps not to go to war with Iran?
Well, I'm fascinated. I think it was Wisconsin where a number of cities had an election on the same day recently on that very topic. And yes, I would be in support of considering a resolution that would ask, you know, Congress to and the president to pull our troops out of Iraq. I don't want to see us go to war with Iran either. No,
so would you? Yeah. But would you actually support the resolution, or would you just support having the resolution?
Well, I think I would support the resolution. I, you know, want to see what the resolution would actually say.
But, okay.
Yeah. The general sentiment, I think, is
and you see that this is that in fact having wars in places like Iraq and Iran actually affects city government, which would be argued
against.
Well,
yeah, certainly it affects all of us. I mean, it affects you know many young people who are giving their lives in those arenas too.
Okay, and that was Dan Tulson, Mike Casper.
I'd be for a resolution to remove our troops from Iraq, and definitely not continue any hostility towards any other countries. I think we have enough problems here at home that we can need to be working on rather than bullying the rest of the world.
Okay, and Amanda Fritz?
I will propose and sponsor a resolution to end the war in Iraq as soon as I get into office. I would have voted for the resolution before. I'm also interested in looking at things that we can do practically for the citizens who are involved most intimately, such as having some kind of parks program where the families of service folks can get free access to community centers and other ways that we can actually support those families and remind everybody in Portland that we are at war and that people are sacrificing for us.
Okay, and Sharon Nesset?
Yes, I would definitely support peace, and I actually am very shocked that we do not hang our mask at half staff while we are in war. I believe the flag should bow its head to the men and women who are serving there and to the people who have died. And I feel very sorry that we have chose to attack another country. And I think when Abraham Lincoln said that preeminent strikes are immoral, that he was as accurate as many of his other statements. And so I'm hoping that we go to the thought of lowering our flag in support of the people who have given their life in the war, and that we move on to a brighter future, because it does affect us in our hearts. And if it doesn't affect the dinner table when you call your family together and know that those members aren't there, you're not paying attention.
Okay, and Chris Iverson?
I would definitely support that resolution. My cousin George Bush is a criminal, and he should be arrested and thrown in jail, or impeached at the very least. This war is a scam. Enron and Halliburton are weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, and then that leads segues to the next question that my engineer Aaron just wants to put before you all. How would you all vote on the upcoming proposal to impeach Bush? Oh, that's a caller's question. Okay, well, Aaron, okay, a caller's question. And this is the way we're actually responding to our callers today. So that's going to be the last question I'll ask each of you today. So.
Well, there's no proposal on the city council agenda. I understand some people are going to present that this morning at our meeting.
Right.
It's not actually an item that we're going to be voting on at this point. You know, I don't know. I guess I'd want to know what are the grounds for impeachment. I don't like George Bush, but I don't think he's committed impeachable offenses. People may disagree with that, but my general inclination, I'll listen to what's said, see what arguments they make in behalf of that, and we'll see where we go from there.
Okay, so for the rest of you, if this were to come up while you, if you were elected to Dan's seat and this comes up in the next session of, or next year in City Council, how would you vote to, would you vote for a proposal to impeach Bush?
Actually, it's funny. I've been thinking about it lately, and I came up with a little phrase, impeach that son of a Bush. So I'm for an impeachment process, or at least to get the investigations going so that we can actually put this information out in front of the people and let them make the decisions.
Okay, that was my Casper. And we got like 1 minute left, so everybody's answers need to be really brief. Amanda Fritz.
I'm not yet convinced that having a re-electable Republican in office in 2008 is a good idea. So I'm open to the idea. I think he has done things that are impeachable. I'm just wondering about the strategy.
And Sharon Nesset?
I think investigations are definitely warranted, and I think that that should come from Congress and from our representatives, and that if they choose to go forward with such a process, then that is something that's not usually voted on by the citizens.
Okay, and finally, Chris Iverson. Well, you already said what you think. So.
I think everybody knows what I think about my cousin George Bush, who I'm 12th cousin with, unfortunately.
Okay.
Definitely impeach the guy.
Okay. Well, I want to thank... Okay, we are just about out of time. I want to thank Dan Saltzman, who is currently city councilor, position number 3, and his opponent in the race, or nicer word...
Co-stars.
Opponent, his co-stars.
We all love Dan.
anyway, and that was Chris Iverson, Sharon Nash, Mike Casper, and Dan Saltzman.
Amanda Fritz.
Amanda Fritz. Dan Saltzman. And I haven't had my coffee yet. Over here, okay. Dan Saltzman had a sex change, a few other things. And Amanda Fritz.
Wait a second. We better stop this show.
But it's just starting to get good.
Yeah, I was just pointing
out. Well, they do need a woman on council.
Okay. Okay. So anyway, thanks all
just
for
kidding.
All, and Dan Saltzman did not have a sex change.
You heard it first here.
Thanks very much for coming, and good luck for all of you in the election next Tuesday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, dear.
Fun.
On a souvent chanté tes ponts à coup d'excès d'accordéon. Pour l'heure, voici que ces plombs vont louer des pics de pollution. Avenue Bel Air ou sur les quais, on voudrait respirer en paix. Quand on sait que tes gaz sont fatales, ça fait sourire, se fait en initiale. Car tu sens si bon l'été, sous ta chape de plomb soufrée, que j'ai l'inspiration fatale. Tu seras toujours romantique, même au temps des pics qui goudronnent tes mains. Pleurer tous les yeux des amants.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KBOO. Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont, and can be reached at 503-288-3422. And it has been made possible in part by Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, Pizzicata Pizza, and all new seating, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland. 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com. Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Wednesday Radio Zine. Up first, it's Movie Talk with the latest on movies. At 9:30, Miriam Widman interviews historian Estelle Friedman on feminism here and abroad. At 10, Scott Forrester hosts a program on the future liberation of Tibet. His guests include a member of the Northwest Tibetan Cultural Association and a Tibetan musician. At 10:30, Ed Goldberg speaks with Dr. Sidney Schwab about his surgical memoir book, Cutting Remarks. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, hear about a controversy at Brandeis University over the dismantling of an art exhibit featuring 17 paintings by Palestinian youths. And Boston columnist James Carroll critiques the military-industrial complex. Now let's go to Movie Talk.